Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In the early 1900s, a Danish artist and ethnographer traveled among the nomadic reindeer herders of northern Scandinavia, gathering stories. Amelia de Montfort brought her own viewpoint to the process, in part because she became close with many female storytellers of the region. In her collected tales, you find stories of clever girls, wise crones, and magic animals, as well as glimpses of tales from other places as they ease their way into the Sami consciousness. Now, University of Minnesota Press has released an English translation of de Montfort's book. It's called By the Fire, Sami Folktales and Legends. It's translated from the Danish by Barbara Schuholm. We spoke with Schuholm last week.
This book has an interesting history. Amelia de Montfort was a Danish ethnographer and artist who spent a number of years doing field work and traveling in Sápmi up in Swedish Lapland, northern Sweden. And during her travels, she spent a lot of time with Sami women and men in their tents. Some of them were nomads and some of them were settlers. And she collected folktales along with a lot of ethnographic detail. Back in Denmark in 1921, something like that, she decided to put together a collection of the folktales called Ved Ilden, By the Fire, and to illustrate it with her own liner cuts. So there wasn't a huge printing of this. There were about 500 copies printed, and it has been out of print in Denmark pretty much ever since. But I had been interested in Amelia for a long time and decided this would be a wonderful book to put into English to translate from Danish.
When did you first come across her story?
I came across it in 2001. I was writing travel articles and traveling around the far north of Scandinavia and Finland, and I stayed with a woman I knew who was a writer, Norwegian writer, married to a Sami man who was a newspaper editor, and she told me the story of a Danish woman who had come up to Lapland at some point, and she had become friendly with a Sami reindeer herder, wolf hunter, Johan Turi, who later became quite famous as the first Sami author who wrote in Sami. And it was his friendship with Amelia that sort of allowed his fame to happen. She encouraged him to write. She took his notebooks back to Denmark and translated them into Danish. So it was published in a bilingual edition in 1910. And so I thought, oh, I have to find out more about this woman. And it took a long time. No one had ever really written very much about her. And she was pretty much forgotten in the world of ethnography. So I spent lots and lots of time over the next 17 years digging around in the archives in Copenhagen and Stockholm.
How do they meet? How does that friendship form?
Well, they met on a train by chance in 1904. Amelia was 31. I think he was about 53. And the train was new. It had just started transporting iron ore from Kiruna to Narvik on the Norwegian coast because the Atlantic was ice-free. So, and the mines in Kiruna were, you know, getting up some steam. And Amelia had come up there with her sister as part of the first wave of tourists. She'd always sort of been fascinated by the Sami, even as a little child. She had told her parents that she wanted to live in the north and be a nomad. So they met by chance on the train, and Amelia and her sister kind of got off the train and went to visit Turi and his family. And then 3 years later, Amelia actually came back there and lived with Turi's sister-in-law and brother, Aslak and Siri Turi, and their four children in a tent for 8 months. And then she lived with another family and traveled over the mountains to Norway on the reindeer migration. So their friendship developed around that. They were not in a romantic relationship, though. I think he was in love with her. She married someone else who was a Danish cultural geographer.
Tell me then, your role as translator, how do you approach this? So you're translating from Danish to English?
Yes, in this case, I also translate from Norwegian.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about how do you approach a text? How do you approach the fullness of this and then figure out how to do that translation?
Well, when I first started working with Amelia, and I translated her other book, With the Lapse in the High Mountains, which was published in 1913, and it's the story of her living with the Sami in northern Sweden and about the migration, and it's kind of a very exciting book with lots of detail. I struggled with that a bit because it had a lot of Sami phrases in it. It had lots and lots of things about reindeer, and the terminology was a little bit daunting to me. I didn't know that in Danish particularly, so I had to get help from various people. I looked in lots of books that had diagrams of tents and reindeer harnesses and things like that to try and find what the right English word would be. The Sami folktales were quite a bit easier. They're written in very direct language, and she collected them in Sami, or a combination of Sami and Swedish, and she then transcribed them in her journals in Danish. So she didn't try and pretty them up. She didn't try and make them more epic or literary. They're very straightforward. And if you compare the book, the stories in her original book, By the Fire, with her notebooks, they're pretty much the same. So my task was really to capture the humor, the eeriness, the straightforward matter-of-factness of the stories. I took out a lot of extra Sami words. I kept the ones that are very powerful and can't be translated in any other way. She had sort of kind of scattered them here and there in the story, but I felt that this book was more for a general audience, so I should really make it as accessible as possible.
There's a poetry in them too, in that matter-of-factness and that directness. Where does that poetry come from? Is that a reflection of the people who told the stories themselves?
I think so. I felt that when I read that, and I tried to be as faithful as possible while, of course, bringing that into English, which has its own rhythms. But I allowed myself to kind of be taken over by the voices of the storytellers and to think, what's the most direct way to tell this? I also read a lot of folktales during this period. I read Philip Pullman's retelling of the Grimm tales, and I looked at earlier translations of Sami work, and sometimes those were really, they were kind of prettified in some ways. So I knew I didn't want to go that direction. I want to stay with the real power of the stories.
So let's talk about those stories themselves, because you mentioned, Grimm stories and other folk tales that have been gathered, throughout different geographies. What are some of the themes that come from these particular stories and these particular people? Before we kind of get into some of those themes, let's put in context the time that they were collected and the different influences that are already acting on those stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stories were collected in the early 20th century, but many of them go back probably centuries. Some Sami people I know have said, oh, yes, I heard that story. I heard the story about how the Sami got the dog that was in our family. So some of them are ancient. The Sami have been around for, 4,000 or 5,000 years up in the north. And they probably were told over and over again through the generations with variations. Some of the stories are more recent, the legends sort of towards the end, and they kind of reflect events that were happening around the turn of the century where the Sami were being more actively persecuted by the Swedish colonists, and the farmers were attempting to drive them off the land. And I think that history influences those legends. They have a folktale feeling to them, but you can actually trace the origin of the story maybe only 20 years back.
Hmm. With the influence of Christianity and missionaries, do you see a marrying of an old traditional story with more contemporary influences to sort of keep that story, being passed down? How do you see those two intersecting?
I think, yes, the Sami were missionized in the 1600s, and then there was a revival in the mid-1800s with the Lestadian religion, which is a kind of evangelical sect of Lutheranism. And so some of the stories, yes, they do have mention of God and Jesus, and there are also some stories that have mentions of kings and princesses. So there are some other forces bearing on the ancient stories. I think Amelia sort of stayed away from mythic stories about, say, the Northern Lights or gods and goddesses. And the Sami have those stories as well. I think she was more interested in stories about animals, stories about spirits, the dead who come back to life. There's some stories that reflect memories of the plague years in Scandinavia about pestilence and how it spreads. There's some really interesting stories about murdered children, and which sort of refer to when children were killed or abandoned for different reasons. And then there are a number of stories about the persecutors of the Sami, the kind of strange beings called the Dog Turks, and the Russian Chudes or bandits, and there are also Stalos, which are kind of like stupid but evil cannibalistic trolls. So all those things are represented in the book.
There are some that are familiar stories, including a young woman in shining clothes whose admirer puts tar on the floor where she leaves behind a shoe, and he comes looking for her, and her sister, who is not as virtuous as she, tries to pass it off as her shoe. And right down to the, you know, in the traditional Grimm tale, the sisters in cut off a heel, cut off a toe to try to fit into the shoe, which is usually taken out of the story, and the birds come and reveal the liar for who they are. That's in here in a different way. There's a Sami Cinderella story.
That's right. I was very surprised to see that. And there are also sort of hints of wicked stepmothers, for instance, or mothers who try and steal things for their own children. There's a king and princess, and there's a sea dragon. So there was a lot of cross-fertilization between the, say, Norwegian fairy tales and the Sami fairy tales, because, of course, people were living in those countries, so they were traveling, they were hearing them, they were even reading them in books at times.
Yeah, I always wonder if those stories were cross-fertilized or if sometimes they were just in our DNA, if somehow, because sometimes it feels like that just every human being, by the nature of being human, tells stories with some similar themes.
Yeah, well, certainly the stepmother story is a common one.
Yeah, well, the reindeer and the sheep, is a very tortoise and hare kind of story, with one animal being in front and the other using trickery to sort of get what they want at the end. When an animal just sort of maybe feels a little too confident about their position in the world.
Exactly. Yeah, there are lots of animal stories that are quite fascinating. I like the one about the fox and the bear. That's a little bit gruesome.
Tell us how, in what context, I want to go back to Amelia and tell me, in what context would she have heard these stories? Like, paint a picture for me of what her travels were like and how these people would have told stories to her.
Well, she has a wonderful description of being up in the Norwegian mountains in 1908 with her host family, the Rostis, Anni Rosti, who was a great storyteller. And she calls her Gata with the Lapps in the high mountains. And so you have to picture that it's spring, it's June, but the winds are raging, sleet is falling. They're on an ice field, and they're in their tent, pole tent. They built a fire, and Anni Rosti is keeping everyone captive with her fantastic storytelling, and flickering on the inside of the tent are sort of shadow figures. And they feel safe in there. Outside is, as Amelia says, the frightening things. But inside, it's home. It's the great good place of safety. So I think the stories were a way of creating community, family, a sense of safety, even though the stories sometimes are scary too, for people who lived very close to the outdoors. You know, they lived often in the wilderness, especially on these grand migrations with the reindeer.
Hmm. How did she see the people she was, kind of collecting these stories from? Does she see colonization and the impact? Is she an outsider who's kind of taking something and leaving? You know, does she change how she views people that she gets to know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that for Amelia, the people that she met were all individuals, and that's really important to emphasize. They were not the Sami.
Yeah.
They were not sort of the other in a way. They were her friends. And some of the women in particular that she collected stories from, she stayed with them quite a while, like Marta Nilsson, who was in her 70s. Amelia stayed in her tent for about 10 weeks, I think, in the summer of 1910, and didn't want to leave. She just thought, I like to keep living here. I like this. So they were individuals to her. But she couldn't help seeing, of course, the many ways in which the Sami had their lands taken away, were bullied, were threatened, were discriminated against. Sometimes she wished her friends would stand up more for themselves, but she admired their resilience tremendously. And even though some people at the time said, oh, the Sami are going to be dying out, you know, this is unsustainable, we must sort of salvage their culture as best we can for anthropology, she kept writing in her journals and elsewhere that, no, they were not in danger of dying out, that they were strong, that they were resilient, that their sense of humor and their sense of culture were really worth preserving, and that they were preserving it. So she saw herself in some ways as an admirer, a partisan, an explainer of the Sami to others. In 1905, when she was up there, Sweden and Denmark had separated, and Norway became independent, and so the border became much more difficult to traverse. The Norwegians did not want the Sami coming over the Swedish border as they had for millennia, with the reindeer in the summer, so the reindeer could calve and feast on the green valleys. And she wrote to the newspapers. She did a lot of work saying, I'm not on the Norwegian side, I'm not on the Swedish side, I'm on the side of the Sami. I don't want to make her out to be a saint of any sort. She was a bourgeois Danish woman as well, and she had her own prejudices. But I think as far as being on the side of the Sami, she definitely was.
After the break, more with Barbara Schuholm about the newly released translation of By the Fire, Sami Folktales and Legends. Barbara also reads us a well-known story, How the Sami Got the Dog, is ahead. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with author and translator Barbara Schuholm. Her translation of the book By the Fire, Sami Folktales and Legends is now available from the University of Minnesota Press. Here we are talking about how Danish ethnographer and artist Amelia DeMont Hott gathered folktales and stories from the nomadic reindeer herders and the challenges and opportunities of dealing with the project in translation. When you mentioned her seeing the people that she meets as individuals, what was your role as a translator then to try to preserve that kind of individual annotation of, you know, who told this story? Where did it come? Who was the person who shared this version? Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things about my work on the book, because in the original, the storytellers are not named at the ends of the stories. In her notes at the back of By the Fire, the Danish version, she lists where the stories came from. And so I hadn't really paid too much attention to that. I just kind of noted it. But when I was working on the biography, and I was retracing her travels and looking very closely at her field journals from those times, I started encountering those folktales in that form in the journals, and I thought, oh, Ani Roski told this story, Martin Nilsson told this story. So I decided that when I did my version of By the Fire, that I would try and reunite the storytellers and their story, which turned out to be completely fascinating. It was not at all impossible to do. It took some work, and a few stories I just couldn't identify with the person because I didn't find it for sure in the field journal. But I did that at first, and then I was fortunate enough to get a fellowship travel grant from the American Scandinavian Foundation, and I went to Sweden, and I spent some time in the folklore archives, and I also went to the Nordic Museum in Stockholm and looked again at Amelia's scrapbooks. She has had photographs of a lot of people. So gradually, I started building up information, biographical information about many of these storytellers. And because I had some contacts in the Sami community, and because other people are working on, you know, recovering the voices of Sami people from the past, and that includes storytellers, I was able to find out quite a bit about maybe four or five of the main storytellers, and also to find their photographs. And I write about them in the afterword. And that was really important to me, to sort of say, Margrethe Bengtsson from Arjeplog in Pita Sapmi, she told these stories. And Martin Nilsson told these stories. And Ani Roski and Elizabeth Rensburg told these stories. I think it's really important. So often folktellers are kind of invisibilized by the people who collect their stories.
Yeah. And were they just everyday people who were in families and telling story, or were they somehow culturally responsible for keeping certain stories? How was that tradition sort of, revealed through the process of research?
I think they were sort of everyday people. I think they might have been recognized as good storytellers. I don't think they were sort of tradition bearers in any kind of formal sense. I think they were just maybe talented at telling certain stories, and they had their own repertoire, and they had their own ways of telling them. I think in the south of Sapmi, in the Härjedalen in Sweden, where there had been a lot of assimilation and conflict and even violence, there was a way that certain legends in particular were passed down. And one woman, Elizabeth Rensburg, was politically active and a herder, and she told her daughter stories, and she told her granddaughter stories, and her granddaughter, Vanya Torkelson, who still lives in Sweden and is older now, and I had some contact with her, she told me in an email that her grandmother felt it was really important to pass these stories on. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the great story at the end about Karin Wildstar, who kind of saves her people from being exterminated. So I think in that sense, there were some who had a kind of political consciousness and a historical idea that it was important to save the stories. Others were just, they loved to tell the stories, and Amelia was lucky enough to be in their presence when they did.
Are these stories still being told today and evolving still?
I would imagine. I'm in Madison right now, and I gave a reading from the book last night at a bookstore, and there was a youngish man who's here for the Scandinavian Studies Conference, and he saw me, and he's a craftsman, Dwoji, he makes Dwoji, and he says, oh, I know that story. I've heard that story in my family. And so that was, you know, that was nice. He was very surprised that it was in English, you know. These stories aren't in Danish, they're not in Swedish, they're not even published in Sami. So it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, I'm sure that will happen, but so far it's just English. He seemed quite bemused by that.
And tell me what he makes. I don't know what that is.
Dwoji is a Sami name for handicrafts. Okay. And it's kind of had a revival in the last 30 years in particular. It's being made for centuries. But he carves on antler and bone, and I've not seen what he makes. I think he's doing some demonstrations here in Madison this week, so I'd like to go by and see them. But others make calfskin purses and tin embroidery, carve bowls, all kinds of interesting things. Clothing as well is considered duodji.
So this must have been a very satisfying, although, you know, all-encompassing project. What when you step back and hold the book in your hand and sort of see the work that represents so much more than just your own work, but that wouldn't exist without your own work. Tell me a little bit as a translator how you sort of stand in that space of book publication and put into perspective what this project was and is.
I feel really pleased with it, and I think partly because I've moved a little bit away from Amelia de Montfort, who's been my focus for about 10 years, into a larger world. Mm. I guess I hadn't realized the extent to which she had understood the Sami predicament in a way. I think this book is more subversive than I thought at first, partly because she chose so many women as her storytellers. And so many of the protagonists of the stories are women. They're plucky young girls, or they're older women who are clever, sometimes have a little bit of sorcery about them. And I think that the more I worked with the stories, the more I was actually kind of blown away by how strong they were, how funny they were, how varied. And I think when you work as a translator, you get to know a text really, really well, and you work with it over and over again, not only in the asking questions stage and the draft stage, but then you have the copy editor asking questions, you have your own editor at the press, you have the proofreader. There are all these ways that you begin to get to know every single word almost. And so when the book is published, you have this sense of, on the one hand, it's the voices of the Sami, it's Amelia's voice, it's my voice too. These are actually my English words. So you have this kind of lovely sense that so many hands have touched this, so many voices have told this, and now it's kind of going further out into the world, and many people will hear this and read this, which I just love. I love that idea.
And many people will read it aloud, because these are stories that are meant to be heard.
Yeah.
Kind of get a little chill there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm doing some, I'm doing some readings over the next month or so in some different places. And one of the things that I thought would be fun to do was to ask some Sami readers, Sami American readers. There are quite a number of immigrants who have Sami background, and I asked if they would like to read the stories with me while I showed slides and talked about Amelia and the background. So in Duluth and Minneapolis and in Seattle, I've got Sami Americans who are participating in this, and that's very exciting for all of us, I think.
Is there a story you could read for us today?
Sure. How the Sami Got the Dog. The Sami first had the white fox for a dog, but it wasn't of much use. It only ran around killing the reindeer calves. After that, they tried to turn the red fox into their helper, but it only ran after the reindeer without barking, and it also killed the calves. The third animal the Sami tried to make a helper was the wolverine. It was better than the other two. It barked and also directed the herd, but all the same, it killed one or two reindeer. One day, when the husband was not at home, just the wife, the wolverine came to the tent and stole food. It broke open a geese and ate everything in it. The wife became angry and thrashed the wolverine. The wolverine now grew angry and ran off. A while later, the husband returned to the tent and asked after the dog, and the wife told him that she had chased it away because it stole. The husband went off, calling for it. But the wolverine answered, "From now on, I'm only going to live in the wilderness and tear the reindeer to pieces." The husband later went to see what the wolverine was up to, and he saw it was killing the reindeer. So the husband killed the wolverine. From that day, the Sami and the wolverine were enemies. Then one day, when the woman was out herding, she saw her dog running. It began to help her by barking. She now saw that the dog was an excellent helper, and she wanted to lure the dog by giving it a piece of meat from her own food stock that she kept inside the tent. At first, the dog didn't dare take it, but then she offered the dog a meat bone, and the dog took the bone. The woman now began to speak to the dog about going into service with them as a reindeer herder, but she was afraid that the dog would want to be paid too much. "Don't be afraid of that," said the dog. "Just give me some soup and the bones, and then I will be satisfied." After that, the dog served the Sami as a reindeer herder. And that was originally told by Margrethe Bankson in Pizza Sakmi in 1914.
Barbara Schuholm, thank you so much. It is a fascinating book and a real treasure to hold in your hand and also to hear read aloud. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure for me, too.